So, I feel like I have to ask, have there been any notable trolls?
There was somebody who said they wished I would die for creating the app. You know, and you kind of have to take that and like, okay, well, you know, either somebody's, you know, totally exaggerating, or somebody's got some issues and probably shouldn't engage with them.
Welcome to Playable Character. I'm your host, Shane Hinton. In each episode, we plan to gather together contributions from individual bloggers, podcasters, developers, and gamers that enrich our understanding of game culture. In our first segment, Trevor Dodge looks at the game Dante's Inferno and asks, what happens when we overlay our expectations of fun onto something like an epic poem?
Fun is almost always the baseline value by which we evaluate something we might call a video game. By nature, we are creatures who prefer the warm fuzzy over the cold prickly, and activities which require us to focus for longer stretches of time and draw more than just summary conclusions about what we've experienced, they're made more difficult when we aren't having a pleasant time doing them. Games and fun, then, might go well together like chocolate and peanut butter. But let's be careful not to assume that these aren't incredibly subjective things we're talking about. When we talk about games as a medium, we are essentially talking about how game designers communicate ideas through building artistic vehicles for those ideas, as well as how game players receive and react to those ideas. When we whittle those efforts down to whether a game is fun or not, a lot gets lost in that trimming. Case in point is Electronic Arts' Dante's Inferno. Of that 2009 release, games critic Lee Alexander wrote, quote, "The Divine Comedy, after all, is largely a poem about two guys walking and talking, not exactly the core gameplay of an action game. In that way, the liberties the design team took were intended to create a stronger video game, a more reasonable priority for, well, a video game, than focusing on a strong epic poem adaptation." She continues, "Gleefully gruesome and literally hellish, the game seems to use the poem's backbone and references to enrich an action game rather than use the game as an attempt to emulate an epic poem in video game form. Audience was like a game that uses the medium's potential to correspond with other cultural sources, and that's an excellent goal." She punctuates her astute observation in asserting, quote, "Dante's Inferno is not that game. It would rather be an action title, and that's okay." I'm lockstep with Alexander in seeking out connections that video games have with other art forms. I, too, believe that finding the places where these media intersect is worthwhile. For me, whether a game is fun or not is almost always secondary to me deciphering what it might be trying to tell me, and then deciding what I ultimately think about that particular argument, issue, or aesthetic. How successful a game is has everything to do with its coherence as an artistic expression, and little, if nothing, to do with its NDP numbers. For me, then, games are a conduit for interactive ideas, arguments, meaning. And the action is that thought, deed, or utterance inspired by the experience of playing said game. So what's the problem, then? It's simple. Caught up in the never-ending cattle rush among other video game publishers to acquire and trademark new brands of intellectual property, intellectual or anti-intellectual, Electronic Arts have translated Dante Alighieri's Comedia into little more than a crudely painted backdrop for yet another insipid action-adventure. Dante's epic poem was written in three sections, Inferno, Purgatory, and Paradise. 33 cantos that comprise Inferno are a lavish litany of revenge and serve to settle a host of scores with his personal enemies. A messy civil turf war in his hometown of Florence landed him in exile, and it was during that angry period late in his life that he began constructing his epic. He created his own game structure in the epic tradition to have his way with political enemies in Florence and also in Rome. Dante was certainly capable of designing that game in the linguistic engine known then as Latin, but his deliberate choice to cobble together in a new Tuscan-Sicilian engine of his own design, something he called Italian, made it clear. He wanted to communicate his ideas to a more diverse audience than what the old engine afforded him. A powerful way to think about his Commedia, then, is as one of Western literature's most elaborate mods. Since Electronic Arts' attention span for Dante's Commedia begins and ends with Inferno, it's important to consider the recognizable symbology and references from that particular section of the epic that so-called, as Alexander calls them, quote, literature buffs still get a kick out of. But more precisely, it's important to consider those references in their proper context. This assumes that we are indeed sincere about finding those places where different cultural sources do that correspond thing that they do. Of course, part of the problem is we already know that old colloquialism about what an assumption makes out of you and me. Enemies for Dante, see, they aren't Beelzebub, Minos, or Lucifer. They aren't fantastic creatures who have fantastic drop items and refuse him passage unless he pulls their brains out through their noses, a la something conjured by the roadkill imagination of someone like David Jaffe. The enemies for Dante, see, they have real names, they've committed real crimes, and in his estimation, they deserve real punishments. Where Electronic Arts' digital Dante is on a collision course with an abstraction called the devil, and tangentially, by the way, can a game studio ever really top the sheer aesthetic and philosophical bliss of Neversoft when they capped Guitar Hero 3 with a down and dirty tete-a-tete with Lou, that dark prince of psychobilly? Dante's conflicts, they're with real people. They're chiefly with Benedetto Caetani, better known as Pope Boniface VIII, who made real enemies through the buying and selling of abstraction itself. Here's the rub. To even begin approximating the underpinnings of Alighieri's 14th century text-based adventure, Dante's Inferno's executive producer Jonathan Knight at EA would need to conceive and deliver anti-papist imagery so graphic and severe that Dan Brown's conspiracy theory novels would truly pale in comparison. But this assumes, there's that word again, that Knight and his development team at Visceral Games, operating, of course, under the banner of EA, one, understand Alighieri's justifications for all the savagery depicted in Inferno, and two, actually care about pulling all those things all the way into the 21st century. And on both counts, this is definitely, probably, assuming far too much. The heart of the matter is that Electronic Arts would no more have us butcher Boniface than miss their annual Madden ship date. NBC, in the 1990s, has never rebroadcast arguably the most incendiary 9 seconds of live television ever shown in the United States, wherein, after performing an a cappella rendition of Bob Marley's War, Irish singer Sinead O'Connor tore up a picture of Pope John Paul II and urged everyone watching to, quote, fight the real enemy. Because if you thought the Catholic League came unhinged over Kevin Smith's Dogma, just imagine its reaction to a video game wherein the player interactor willfully exacts corporal punishment upon a pope. And this, friends, is part of the reason why venturing into that wasteland of conversation titled When Will Video Games Have Their Citizen Kane Moment? Is still largely a waste of time. For Orson Welles, making Kane wasn't about exercising a studio's intellectual property rights, but exorcising his personal political demons. Kane is a work of art perfectly and hermetically sealed within its historical moment, yet it's an expression so precise, poisonous, and yes, personal, that its angry energy still infects us, as a white dwarf high-beaming us from only a century away. Like Virgil and Dante, Wells's voice refused to be ignored because of its arrogance, audacity, and white-hot brilliance, and he himself suffered great injury for his inability to darken or cool it. Adding insult to injury, as a tangent, by the way, Wells's original negative of the film was lost in a fire, a literal one, at his Spanish villa in the 1970s. Art It endures. It's convulsive, and it twists itself into the future. Not unlike the film industry during Hollywood's golden age, the video game industry now has a pantheon of studio-beholden stars who make compelling work, sure, but still it's work that is primarily, and a lot of times only, produced to be consumed and not considered. Frequently, the attempt to seriously consider these expressions is met with that familiar anti-intellectual ditty titled, "Oh, let it go, it's just a game," or "It's just a movie," or "It's just a comic book," or whatever you want to insert in there. As much as we might try to convince ourselves otherwise, we do not live in an age of ideas, or even an age of information. We, my friends, live in an age of anti-intellectual property. So, Alexander's final analysis in this, our glorious age of anti-intellectual property, it's sadly prudent and pragmatic and accurate. Things are what they are. Everything that is what it is. And that's okay. I mean, right? You tell me.
Next segment, I spoke with game designer, developer, programmer, and composer Eric Lawyer of Opportune about the challenges and possibilities of interactive storytelling and his iPhone and iPad app, Strange Rain.
Strange Rain basically turns your device into a skylight on a rainy day, and so as you're holding the device, you're seeing raindrops kind of falling out of the sky, hitting the screen. As you touch the screen, you can kind of shape the direction of the raindrops. And there's a few different play modes. So you can just experience it as a rain simulation with music that kind of goes with each tap. There's another mode called Whispers mode that starts turning some of the raindrops into words as they fall and hit the screen. And then there's a story mode where every tap shows a thought of a character, and you're kind of in the mind of this character. And so as you're tapping and dragging, you're seeing these thoughts unfold. This guy who's experiencing kind of a family crisis and has gone out into the rain to try and clear his head. So you're walking through his thoughts kind of step by step as you tap through the experience. I knew I wanted to do some kind of text or story element, but wasn't quite sure what it would be. And I didn't want it to feel like it was just kind of glommed onto this rain experience. The first time I showed it in public, it was mostly like the Whispers mode. There were some words that kind of came here and there, but there wasn't a story at all. But actually after going to IndieCade in the last fall, got really inspired about trying to figure out how to make a story work. And so spent about a month and a half or so playing around with what the dynamics of the story would be and how you would interact with it and working all that stuff out. I'm always trying to get words on screen into stuff. I always like to see text integrated in the environment. It was an early goal, but trying to figure out how to do it and make it work. And also dealing with folks' expectations of how interactive the story was going to be. Because as soon as you kind of say, hey, there's a story, I think people have a certain expectation that you're going to interact with the plot and you're going to make plot decisions. And it really wasn't the concept, to try and do a choose your own adventure or multiple choice kind of plot thing, that it was really more about performing these thoughts. And so after the first beta test, I got some feedback that people felt like, I want more control, I want to make more choices. And so I really had to think hard about, okay, how do I position the whole experience so that that desire is less intense for people, even though they may be used to it. So that was a big part of the struggle with getting the story mode going too. As you're tapping and dragging, you're triggering individual notes of the score. It's not as if you're activating loops or layers in the score, which is kind of the typical way it's done. but it's more about individual notes. You're kind of affecting the pace of the music, the tempo of the music, the rhythm of the music, and that intimacy kind of signals the way that I want people to approach the narrative. And it's just really this step-by-step, you know, intimate kind of performance, and not to be in the headspace of strategizing, you know, of trying to figure out, well, if I do this, then maybe that'll happen and that'll lead to this outcome. Trying to short circuit that strategizing mentality. I love this whole idea of the musical. And when you think of like a classical Hollywood musical, characters burst into song and they're instantly eloquent about the experience that they're going through, the life that they're living right now. For me, that's kind of a metaphor for living life kind of to its peak, that there are those peak moments where you feel like you know what you're doing, at the same time as you don't quite know what you're doing, that there's this kind of sense of mystery, but also purpose integrated at the same time. I think some of my favorite game experiences do that, but they tend to be isolated experiences within a whole game. And what I'm trying to do is kind of expand that experience so that you're having that, you know, most of the time that you're playing it, that you're kind of wading into this world that you don't quite understand, but there's also a sense that you're going to be taken care of, that the experience is sensitive to the ways in which you intuitively want to shape it and perform it, and to try and give you that, that kind of double mindset of purpose and yet mystery at the same time. To me, the personal story is the only place to be in a lot of ways. Like, if we're not able to use these technologies to get into personal stories, you know, that are, you know, intensely inspired by what you're going through as a living human being, then, you know, what good are they? You know, what other reason is there to take on an artistic, you know, driven experience in this format? So that for me is always been a drive in creating, you know, the work that I do on my own is, you know, I'm living life as a human being and I'm processing it and trying to figure out what the heck's going on. And I'm trying to take what I learn and experience and, you know, process it by doing these works. And, you know, a lot of, you know, this piece ended up coming out of my mom being ill for a certain amount of time a few years ago. You know, she was very, very ill. She recovered, thankfully. But that whole experience of being there in the hospital, being at someone's bedside, the helplessness that you feel, very much, you know, informed this piece, you know, and was something that's obviously been an important part of my life for the last few years. And comes out in these kind of works, and that's the way I feel like it should be. One of the things that I loved about putting Strange Rain together was little touches like if you know, as you're on the iPad and the iPhone, as you're touching it, if you look at the thoughts, they rotate a little bit. You know, they kind of tilt to the left a little bit if you're touching to the left, and they tilt to the right a bit if you're touching to the right. And that geometry is actually designed so that the center of the circle that rotation is describing is actually in your body. The axis around which the thoughts are rotating is designed to approximate where your body is, where you're holding it. So it literally, like, these thoughts are actually orbiting around you kind of virtually. And, you know, that's just so fun to be able to do that kind of stuff in a piece like this. You know, even if nobody really quite picks up on it, I think it's one of these subliminal things that, you know, yeah, these thoughts are orbiting around you. So who must be thinking them? You must be thinking them. I'm really interested in this whole idea of images, text, and music, and all of the different forms that those things already exist in kind of outside of the computer. But when they become dynamic and interactive, what kind of new formats are possible there? I'm very interested in comics. And one project that I'm working on upcoming is that, you know, thinking through the visual language of comics when you get touch involved. And lots of folks are experimenting with that right now. It's something that I think, you know, has a lot of potential. You know, and even Strange Rain has proved to be more rich than I expected it was going to be, in terms of people being interested in additional content people liking this way of interacting with the story and wanting more, more different variations on that. So, you know, I'm also exploring that as well. It's nice to have a piece that feels like you can kind of dig into for a while and explore the potential there.
In our final segment, Sean Ryder and his orcish wife get stuck inside of a bug in the Elder Scrolls Oblivion and tell us what it's like on the other side of a digital black hole. I have an orcish wife in Tamriel. Well, I call her my wife. I'm not sure what the common law marriage rules are like in Cyrodiil, and I can't find anyone to marry us officially, yet. Her name is Mazoga, and she's my best friend. She says so. My name is Pendleton Barkey, for the blanket on my legs and the sound the dog makes. I am in a Red Guard, and I have no past. My history starts when I regain consciousness deep in the dungeons of the Imperial City. I have no idea why I was there. I don't know how long I would have stayed there were it not for the Emperor himself, who passed through my prison cell to access a hidden passageway. The Emperor and his immediate guard were fleeing an all-out choreographed assassination attempt, and in the chaos of the moment, Uriel Septim, Emperor of all Tamriel, personally set me free. It was a good day, if a bit disorienting. Since that day, it's as if I'm a new person. I've awakened a Pendleton Barkey I never knew, or didn't think I ever knew. I have made many comrades, but all in passing. Of course, I sweet-talk the ladies, and I knuckle down on the merchants, but it's all fluff. I have solved the mystery of the Emperor's assassination, and I personally saved every city in Cyrodiil from imminent doom, from oblivion. I have quite literally gone to hell and back, yet I have not found a single other with whom I can share my glory, not even a pet. I have seen others with sidekicks, wives, husbands, wolves. Why couldn't a hero, a champion, a grand champion, find a companion? I am lonesome in Tamriel. Well, I was lonesome. On a trip through Leia Wynn, I stopped to see my old friend Count Cairo. We had done some business when I saved the city from an oblivion gate, and I remembered he had another favor to ask when I got through saving the world. That was when he told me about her, Mazoga.
I need your help. An orc named Mazoga here claims to be a knight, but will not reveal her business. Find out why she is here and report to me, and you will earn a reward suitable for those who serve Leia.
Mazoga is an orc, or should I say, Sir Mazoga, as I'm introducing you to her for the first time, but I believe that we are now such good friends, she won't mind me referring to her as simply Mazoga. Mazoga. Light of my life, fire of my loins. She has the most green skin and the cutest upturned nose. She has a husky, deep voice, sultry and enticing. Her hair is arranged in exquisite black plugs that pepper her otherwise bare skull. Those beautiful teeth. She is bold and forthright, never afraid to tussle, and I've personally seen her take a man's life in just a few swings of her two-handed sword. She is a sight to behold, and a knight to boot.
The Count? Then I can talk to you. I'm Mazoga.
She would have been a knight, at least, if she hadn't met me. She showed up in Leia Wynn and loitered around Count Marius Caro's court, asking after Weebum Naa, an Argonian hunter who lives in the city. Count Cairo was nervous about her presence and unsure if she could be trusted, but I think that Cairo just doesn't like orcs. You don't see hardly any in Leia Wynn. I usually don't go looking for discrimination. I'm as fine with the lizard people as I am with the cat people, and to be honest, a warrior's blade or a merchant's stock is really all I care about. But at any rate, the Count figured since he could trust me, I should check out Mazoga and get her story. I found her in the Castle City Hall. By a planter. She was surly at first. Sir Mazoga, she wanted me to call her. I was smitten. As it happened, Mazoga wanted Weebum Naa because he could tell her where Fisherman's Rock is located. It gets a little soap operatic, But the short story is that Mazoga was in Leia Wynn for the entirely noble goal of seeking blood revenge for the murder of her friend. I helped her kill the band of outlaws, and I thought that would be the last I saw of Mazoga. It wasn't. After returning to let Count Cairo know Mazoga's reasons for loitering in his cell, Cairo wanted us to perform a favor in exchange for knighthood admission into the Honorable Order, the Knights of the White Stallion. Cairo asked Mazoga and me to do what we could to eliminate the Black Brugo, leader of the Black Bows. Brugo is a terrible outlaw who murders and robs innocent civilians in the area. Mazoga, bless her heart, had run with Brugo's gang in the past, and she led me to Lipe, where the Black Bows meet weekly to handle payroll. We journeyed to Talipe, and on this trip, Mazoga was giddy. She called me her best friend, and when we met the Black Bows, we destroyed them with impunity. It was a good day, that Tirdas so long ago. And as night fell, we stood around the campfire outside of the ancient Aeliad ruins. Mazoga kept me company, reassuring me that Brugo would show up any time. He never did. We spent weeks, months revisiting the ruins, slaughtering dozens of Black Bows and camping in front of the ruins. All Mazoga wanted was to become a knight. If we completed our task, her dreams would come true. But try as we might, we cannot find Brugo. Eventually, it was undeniable. Brugo had been murdered somewhere else, or else he had heard of our reign of terror and given up the game. I think he's still out there, or at least the Count Leowin thinks he's still out there, and he won't give us our knighthood. Mazoga doesn't know what to do with herself. She follows me around constantly. We've had many good adventures, but as I grow in power, she is more and more endangered. After one too many close calls, routing evil spirits from deep, mysterious ruins, it became clear that I could not keep her safe if she stayed with me. I would have to leave her behind. So where could I put her except in my house? I told her to stay in my home in Leia Wynn, which is a cozy little shack. I rarely use it, so it's all hers most of the time. She seems to like it there, but she has never really gotten past the Brugo experience. I know that deep down inside she wants to be a knight errant, roaming the countryside on behalf of her lord. But now, thanks to me, well, thanks to Brugo and me, she is a housewife. She is always there for me. Whenever Cyrodiil becomes too lonely, I can return to my home in Leia Wynn and my beautiful Mazoga, eternally waiting for me and ready to take out Brugo and his thugs. She happily greets me and never lets it show how disappointed she is that I've given up the quest. I have done all that I can, barring some kind of magical alteration to the world to make Brugo appear. I cannot do anything to help her succeed in her goals. My goals. I never wanted to be your keeper, Mazoga. I wanted to be your friend, your confidant, your companion. I wanted us to grow together, but now you've become the homebody you never wanted to be, and I continue my vagrant lifestyle, checking in on you occasionally and wondering if this is what Abraham Lincoln felt like. It cannot remain this way forever. Perhaps I will buy you a kitchen set or a living room. If you see Brugo, tell him that Pendleton Barkey is after him. I've searched every town in Cyrodiil, and I'm not stopping there. Someday, somewhere, in this vast province, I will find Brugo. I will hunt him, find him, and kill him. And then I will set free that which I have come to love.
Concludes this episode of Playable Character. Our intro music, transition music, and the music in the first segment today was provided by DJ Funkin' Wagnalls. The music in the Strange Rain segment was composed by Eric Lawyer and captured directly from the Strange Rain app, and the music in our third segment is by Benedette Erica. The track we're about to leave you with was written by Carl Strode, aka Captain Buzz, and is the prize-winning Parappa the Rappa 2 contest rap used courtesy of Games First. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I'm a chicken goddess, your beef jerky. It's the BA to the RA to the double BA2. The BA to the RA to the double BA2. The BA to the RA to the double BA2. The BA to the RA to the double BA2. Remember the days in television games? Dracula and AD&D paved the way for Apex Sega Mastery Systems. List them, and I had from Vectrex to NES, Genesis, Commodores, played Contra to early more with 30 extra men. Now I'm lost in dungeons for fun, shining in the darkness, embarking on epic ships, Starbuck ships, while the 3D era's about to flip. The scene blew up thanks to PlayStation, while Saturn thrived in other nations. Import the gems, now it's time for next gen. Strap on the black belt again and attack with Katana. Gaming Nirvana, casting you through